You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Put some distance between you and boredom during social distancing.
Click socialdistance.co.za.
Joining me on the show is an excellent world-class professor of psychology who's based at Yale University, Professor Laurie Santos. Many of you may be familiar with The Happiness Lab, an excellent international podcast that does incredibly well to travel to help us practically think through psychology in ways that can make a difference to us. And as we are all battling the world over with COVID-19 as a global pandemic, questions of how we are affected, not just physically, but also at a psychosocial level, are deeply, deeply important. And I thought it would be absolutely awesome if someone like Professor Santos could be joining us on this platform. And then, fortunately, my excellent producer, Laura, unbeknownst to me, reached out to her, and we've tried to make it work, and we have succeeded despite the time differences. Professor Santos, love your work, and thank you so much for coming on the Eusebius McKayser Show here in Johannesburg.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to get straight into the question of motives. We have announced here in South Africa a national lockdown that will start from Thursday midnight. And it's quite interesting to see how people are behaving after our president had announced it. For example, there's panic buying that goes on at our retailers. A lot of people are anxious. I've got a colleague who is, as we speak, on his way to go and console a sibling who fears that this may be the end of the world. At a psychological level, how does one navigate feeling quite literally as if it's all doom and gloom?
Yeah, well, I think the good news is that what the science suggests is that we always have a different way to frame things if we want to, right? We could see this as doom and gloom and woe is me, or we could see this as a time when we can sort of show our resilience. Like South Africa as a country can come together and cooperate and stop this virus in a way that no other country has, right? There are different frames we could give. We could frame it as a way to write our future story, a story of resilience and strength in the face of challenge. Mm. We could think of it as a challenge to get through. You know, this is a time when, you know, I'm stuck at home with my family and I have to, you know, figure out how to make work and family work. And this is an interesting challenge for us to figure out together. And so I think that there, even though a lot of people are framing this in terms of something really scary, and it is something scary, we can still take the frame that this is a challenge to be overcome, something we can be proud of at the end.
Yeah, let's take some practical examples of that reframing. I heard you make that point in an interview over the last week, and it was really interesting. One of my own listeners on this show had a spontaneous example that made me immediately think back to when I'd heard you make the point about reframing. And he had said, being stuck at home with his children now because the schools are closed here in South Africa as well, like in many other countries, he is seeing it as a positive opportunity to be able to spend some time with children, where ordinarily, if you are, for example, a hardworking mom or dad, you have to go out, make sure that you keep, that you earn a living. But one of the consequences of that is that you may have less time to spend with your children. And when he said that, I thought to myself, that is probably exactly what you meant by the reframing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are, even in really awful times, there are often lots of silver linings that we could look for if you just kind of take a look. I mean, I think reframing time with your children and time with your family as happy time is fantastic. I mean, even as a kid, I remember, you know, here in the U.S. in the Northeast, we have these big snowstorms. And when I was a young child, we had this huge blizzard that, you know, just stopped everything for a week. And those are some of my fondest memories with my dad and my mom, just being home, you know, like with this free time to just all be together. And, you know, all our kids, this whole generation is going to have that growing up where they feel closer with their family and so on. And so that's not to mitigate the challenges ahead. I mean, there are mental health challenges, there are physical health challenges, there are economic challenges. Those things are real, but we're going to get through all of those things better if we can put ourselves in a frame of mind to think about this sort of crisis as a challenge rather than a kind of tragedy.
What are the psychological consequences of self-isolation?
Yeah, well, they're not great. What the psychological isolation and loneliness in particular is pretty bad for us. In fact, there's research suggesting that experiencing loneliness can be as bad for your physical health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Yep. It's bad for your heart. It's bad for your immune system. And it's bad for your psychological health. It causes things like anxiety and depression and so on. Mm. But the good news here, too, is that even though we have to physically isolate, that doesn't necessarily mean socially isolating. And that's what's different in this current crisis than previous ones, say, you know, the flu pandemic in 1918. We have technologies that allow us to connect. You know, you and I are doing it right now. You know, it's 7 a.m. here in New Haven, Connecticut in the U.S., and I'm talking to someone in Johannesburg, right? Our technologies allow us to connect in ways that have never existed for the human species. And that can let us, you know, connect with friends who are down the street. It can let us connect with friends we haven't talked to around the world. We just have to make use of those opportunities in order to fight loneliness.
How do we deal with collective action problems psychologically? And what I mean by that is human beings not cooperating when we all should be. So, for example, it's one thing for the state to say, don't stock up on more than you need. We don't have an insufficient amount of food for the next 3 months. We will allow you to go grocery shopping. The lockdown won't stop you from going to your local retailer during the national lockdown. And despite that, we are seeing here in Johannesburg this morning at many retailers, you see people not maintaining the required amount of distance between themselves and others inside the retail shops. And in addition to that, many are buying more than they need in terms of goods and food. And that to me seems like a pretty good example of, at the group level, failure to cooperate for the sake of the collective good in an effective manner.
Yeah, I mean, I think these things definitely come up, especially in times of fear and uncertainty. Those two emotions don't help us make rational decisions. They don't help us make compassionate decisions and cooperative decisions. And there is a lot of those emotions going around. But at the same time, if you look, you can also find amazing examples of people doing nice things for others, too. I think the panic buying and people fighting over toilet paper, you know, that gets a lot of airtime. I think there were videos of Australians doing that in my feed for several days, right? But those were two Australians, you know, in a sea of many people who are doing all kinds of great things, contacting their elderly neighbors to help, checking in on other people, in some cases using financial windfalls, you know, the money you're saving from your commute every day to help others. Like, this is also going around too, but I think it gets less airtime. You know, the doom and gloom gets clicks on social media and clicks on newspaper sites, and we don't often focus on the positives. But if you look out there, there are a lot of people doing fantastic stuff too. I think the collective action crises can sometimes be overblown, and that's potentially problematic because, you know, even if I wasn't planning to panic buy, if I think literally all of the people in my neighborhood are panic buying, I might start too, right? That might be a rational decision if everybody's defecting and not cooperating. But in practice, if those statistics are the way that, you know, I think they really are when you go out to the local shop, which is like, yeah, some people are doing that, but most people are, you know, stocking up on the things they need for 2 weeks and being calm about it, or maybe stocking up on a few extra because they're kind of helping their elderly neighbor and so on. So I think that there are still, despite those obvious examples of people doing the wrong thing, there's a ton of people doing really amazing things. And if your listeners need a way to see that, go on Twitter and look at the hashtag COVIDKindness, and you'll see so many examples of people doing great things and really being careful about the collective action problem.
What is your advice as a psychology professor to what folks can do during this time, particularly during a national lockdown, to make sure that they maintain good mental health?
Yeah, well, there's lots of different, very specific tips. So one is to have, both for you and your family, especially your kids, if you have young children, as much of a routine as possible. And that routine is going to be different than when you were heading out to work, but make one anyway. you know, even if your kids aren't learning at home, you know, have time where, you know, TV time is from 9 to 10 and then from 10 to 11, we're going to switch and do something else. The mind really resonates with routine and habit. And the more we can give our minds those things in these times, the more we can reduce uncertainty and anxiety and just the kind of overwhelm that comes from kind of, what am I even doing with myself right now? A second tip would just be to monitor your emotions a little bit more than you usually would. This is a good tip generally to kind of take stock of, what am I feeling, anxious or fearful or sad? Like, what's going on in my body? But I think just since we're so prone to anxiety in an anxiety producing and uncertain situation like this, it's good to recognize when your bodies are feeling that. And so if you notice that your chest is kind of tight and that you're breathing really shallowly, really just take time to take what we call three conscious breaths. Just really slowly breathe in and then breathe out. And make sure you're doing that kind of from the lower part of your body, from your belly. You'll be surprised how good that makes you feel. And it feels good scientifically, because what you're doing is you're activating the parasympathetic nervous system, that part of our autonomic nervous system that allows us to rest and digest. You can literally activate it by taking these deep belly breaths, and that can go a long way to reducing stress and sort of decreasing anxiety.
Absolutely. I wonder whether we can explore a second last theme, and this is a big one, but let's see if we can make a little bit of progress in a minute or three and just plant some seeds with me and my listeners here in Johannesburg. I've got an intuition, Professor, that one of the reasons why this is a difficult time for many of us is that we are also confronted with our own mortality in a way that we don't ordinarily like to be confronted. No one is immune to potentially being infected. No two bodies behave the same. You don't know whether if you get infected with COVID-19, you'll get a mild version that your body can ward off, or whether you will be in an ICU unit somewhere, and whether it will be lethal or the treatment will be effective. And for a lot of people, there are deep existential issues perhaps that will be surfacing, including questions about my own individual mortality, and perhaps even that of our species, or at least large numbers of our countrymen and women in a particular geography. Speak into that for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a real concern. I think this is one that comes up a lot. I can say for myself, my mom is very old. She's in her 70s and she has COPD, which really affects her lungs. And she can sometimes go to the hospital with just a really mild cold. And so, you know, if she gets this, you know, it's very likely that she's going to be one of the people who does not react well. And that is incredibly scary. But again, we could react to it in a few different ways. Like, I have control over whether I react to that in absolute panic and breakdown, or whether I react to it in some ways the right way, which is to say, okay, you know, it actually was always uncertain whether my mom was going to make it, right? You know, she's getting up there, like, you know, life isn't certain for any of us. And what that means is that we have the opportunity to realize that and savor it now. You know, so for me, that's involved me calling her a lot more, you know, having time for just sort of games and FaceTime across the way, even though she lives kind of far away from me. I'm trying to take time to savor that right now. And I think that's the way to face a lot of these existential crises. I think, you know, it's partly our own mortality, but it's partly our economic systems. You know, you just thought that work was a given and we'd all go to work, but, you know, this week we're all going to be home. Like, that's kind of strange. You know, we have certain ideas about our family life and that's changing around too. And so I think that with these existential concerns, it always brings a lot of anxiety. But the key is to realize that scientifically speaking, you can control that. It doesn't feel like it, but you really can with simple breaths and simple reframing. That's what the research suggests. And what the research suggests is you can't necessarily control mortality. None of us can do that.
Yeah.
But you can make sure that the life you're living now is as happy as it can be, and as you can savor life as much as you can.
Which takes me to the last theme. Not just happiness matters to us, as per your podcast titled The Happiness Lab, but also The Good Life, and your course that has that title in it, Psychology and The Good Life, became the most popular course in Yale's history in 2018. Give my listeners a sense of what the curriculum content is about, and then your reflections as a professor and a public commentator on why you think, besides being excellent and wonderful to listen to as a teacher and researcher, why do you think there is such enormous interest in your work?
Well, if your listeners want, they can check out the class themselves. We've put a version of it on Coursera.org. On Coursera, it's called The Science of Well-Being. But just in the last 2 weeks, we've had 500,000 people sign up, which is really incredible. Just to give you a sense, we only had about 500,000 for the entire 2 years that the course was up there. And then in just 2 weeks, we've had 500,000 more people sign up. And so I think people are scared. You know, people realize that this is a time where they need to protect their mental health as well as their physical health. And what the class does is it gives you scientifically backed ways to do that. You'll hear about the science of what really causes happiness and allows you to feel a better mood and increased well-being. But you'll also get incredibly specific practical tips that you can put into effect right now. And I think it's more important now than ever to put these things into effect, kind of given the real mental health challenge we're all facing right now.
So that's Coursera. That's Course, Coursera. And it's currently available for free. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. We wanted it to make it available to as many people as possible. And the podcast, The Happiness Lab, is available wherever you get your podcasts online.
Maybe a final question, and we can explore this in future because we don't have much time left. But I did want to know, I've always been, as a student of philosophy, interested in this. But I think, yeah, philosophy and psychology have got to be in conversation with each other, because this is both a normative as well as a empirical psychological question. Over the course of your career, in the most simple way possible for now, we can do the more complex version in future, what have you come to think of as the answer to the question, what constitutes happiness and what constitutes a good life?
Yeah, well, I use the nerdy scientist definition of happiness just to make it easy, which is that happiness involves having well-being in your life and with your life. So you want to have lots of positive emotions in your life, and, you know, relatively few negative emotions in your life. But then you also want to be happy with your life. So that means kind of being satisfied with your life. In terms of how that interacts with the good life, I feel like if you maximize both of those things, and you're able to do it in a way that doesn't harm others, that really can allow you to say that you're experiencing a good life. And what the science suggests is that we can experience a good life and a happy life no matter what our circumstances, if we put our mind to it.
Absolutely. And there are many different good lives. One of them is pursuit of certain intellectual curiosities. And your work is partly, I think, constitutive of a good life that you have, and we benefit from it publicly as well, for which I want to thank you, Professor. Thank you so much for getting up early and making time for us. It's been an enormous pleasure, and I hope we have another opportunity, provided that as a species we cooperate in the face of this current pandemic. Thank you so much for coming on this occasion.
Thanks for having me on the show.
That was Professor Laurie Santos, who's a professor at Yale University in psychology, responsible for the historically popular, most popular course there called Psychology and the Good Life. You can check it out for free at the moment. Go to Coursera. That's Course as in Course, E-R-A at the end, 1-E. Check it out. And also check out, of course, her podcast, The Happiness Lab, that is well known internationally.
Because you are vicariously liable. Remember, Coeda does not sit with you in the domestic workers' environment yet.
That's really fascinating. Let's take a quick break there.
I'm sorry, I didn't want to scare her.
No, but the facts are important. We have got to be guided by them. We are arming every one of us with the necessary information, and that's why you fulfill such a brilliant service for us, Natasha. We've got a couple more calls. Can I abuse our relationship and keep you on for a little while longer?
Remotely, absolute pleasure.
It's 11:30.